Harper Audio presents Not My Father's Son, written and read by Alan Cumming. For Mary D., the Two Toms, and Grant Schaefer. Part 1. Then and Now. Then. You need a haircut, boy. My father had only glanced at me across the kitchen table as he spoke, but I had already seen in his eyes the coming storm. I tried to speak, but the fear that now engulfed me made it hard to swallow, and all that came out was a little gasping sound that hurt my throat even more. And I knew speaking would only make things worse, make him despise me more, make him pounce sooner. That was the worst bit, the waiting. I never knew exactly when it would come, and that, I know, was his favourite part. As usual, we had eaten our evening meal in near silence until my father had spoken. Until recently, my older brother, Tom, would have been seated where I was now, helping to deflect the gaze of impending rage that was now focused entirely upon me. But Tom had a job now. He left every morning in a shirt and tie, and our father hated him for it. Tom was no longer in his thrall. Tom had escaped. I hadn't been so lucky yet. My mother tried to intervene. "I'll take him to the barber's on Saturday morning, Ali," she said.
"He'll be working on Saturday. He's not getting away with slouching off his work again. There's too much of that going on in this house. Do you hear me?"
"Yes," I managed. But now I knew it was a lost cause. It wasn't just a haircut. It was now my physical shortcomings as a labourer, my inability to perform the tasks he gave me every weekend and many evenings, tasks I was unable to perform because I was 12, but mostly because he wanted me to fail at them so he could hit me. You see, I understood my father. I had learned from a very young age to interpret the tone of every word he uttered, his body language, the energy he brought into a room. It has not been pleasant as an adult to realise that dealing with my father's violence was the beginning of my studies of acting. "I can get one tomorrow at school lunchtime." My voice trailed off in that way I knew sounded too pleading, too weak, but I couldn't help it. "Yes, do that, pet," my mum said kindly. I could sense the optimism in her tone, and I loved her for it. But I knew it was false optimism, denial. This was going to end badly, and there was no way to prevent it. Every night, getting off the school bus, walking through the gates of the estate where we lived, past the sawmill yard where my father reigned, and towards our house, was like a lottery. Would he be home yet? What mood would he be in? As soon as I entered the house and changed out of my school uniform and began my chores, bringing wood and coal in for the fire, starting the fire, setting the table, warming the plates, putting the potatoes on to boil, I felt a bit safer. You see, by then I was on his territory, under his command. I worked for him, and that seemed to calm my father, as though my utter servitude was necessary to his well-being. I still wasn't completely safe, of course. I was never safe. But those chores were so ingrained in me, and I felt I did them well enough that even if he did inspect them, I would pass muster, so I could breathe a little easier until we sat down to eat. My father was the head forester of Panmure Estate, a country estate near Carnoustie on the east coast of Scotland. The estate was vast, with 50 farms and thousands of acres of woodland covering over 21 square miles of land. We lived on what was known as the estate premises, the grounds of Panmure House, though by the time we lived there, the big house was long gone. In 1955, as one of many such austerity measures forced upon the landed aristocracy, its treasures were dismantled and then explosives razed it to the ground. All that remained were the stables, where on chilly Saturday mornings during hunting season I'd report, banging my wellies together to keep the feeling in my toes, to work as a beater, hitting trees with a stick in a line of other country boys, scaring the birds up into the air so that drunk rich men could shoot at them. Attached still to the stables was the building that had been the house's chapel. Now it was used for the annual estate Christmas party, and occasional dances or card game evenings for the workers. We lived in Nursery House, so called because it looked out on a tree nursery, where seedlings were hatched and nurtured to replace the trees that were constantly felled and sent back to the sawmill that lay up the yard behind us. My father was in charge of the whole process, from the seeds all the way to the cut lumber and everything in between, as well as the general upkeep of the grounds. It was all very feudal and a bit Downton Abbey, minus the Abbey, and 50 years later. I answered the door to men who referred to my father as the Maester. There were gamekeepers and big gates and sweeping drives and follies, but no lord of the manor, as during the time we lived there, the place was owned by, respectively, a family shipping company, a racehorse owner's charitable trust, and then a huge insurance company. I didn't know it at the time, but I was living through the end of an era of grand Scottish estates, as now, like Panmure, they'd been mostly all dismantled and sold off. Looking back on it, it was a beautiful place to grow up. But at the time, all I wanted was to get as far away as possible. I had seen my father's van parked by the tractor shed as I walked by, so he was home. But maybe he wasn't actually in the house. Maybe he was talking to one of his men in the sawmill or in one of the storehouses or sheds. It was the time of day when they were coming back from the woods and cleaning their tools before going home. I couldn't see my dad, although I didn't want to be seen to be looking for him in case he spotted me, and he'd know that my fear was guiding my search. That would be his opening. Maybe there would be someone in the yard who'd come to see him, a farmer, or even his boss, the estate factor or manager, who would allow me to get by without inspection. I turned round the corner into the driveway of our house at the bottom of the sawmill yard, and I could see there was a light on in his office. My heart sank. He was sitting at his desk in the window, and he looked up when he saw me. Immediately, I straightened, tried to remember all the things he told me were wrong about me recently. I prayed my hair was combed the way he liked it, my school bag was hanging on my shoulder at the right angle, and my shoes were shiny enough. It probably only took 10 seconds before I reached the front door and was out of his sight. But in that flash, a myriad of anxieties about my flaws and failures had whirred across my mind. He was on the phone, thankfully. He didn't come out of his office even until after my mum came home from work, and I always felt a little lighter having her in the house. She finished making our tea while we chatted. Then we heard the noise of him approaching through the house towards us, and we were quiet. We both knew it was not a good idea to speak until we had appraised him, and tonight, apparently, it was not a good idea to speak at all. My father sat into his chair at the kitchen table, and immediately my mother set down his plate of food in front of him. This is how it always happened. Any deviation, let alone any complaint about the food, could start him off. Without acknowledging her or me, he lifted his cutlery and began to eat. He ate like an animal, not because he was messy or noisy, but because he tore at his food with strength and stealth and efficiency. It was terrifying to watch. My father was silent for a while after my mum spoke, and I hoped that my going to the barber's during school lunch break the next day would appease him. All I could think of was getting to the end of this meal and upstairs to my homework, or better yet, far into the woods with my dog to hide. But my mouth was so dry, and there was a lump of fear stuck at the top of my chest that made it hard to swallow. I had to get some water or I was going to choke, or worse, cry. I got up from the table and moved towards the sink. I picked up a glass off the draining board and began to fill it. "What the hell do you think you're doing?" he said, not quite shouting yet, but still too loud, as though he'd been waiting to say it, eager to make the next move, and now here it was. "Hey, did you hear me?" "I need to drink some water," I gasped. "Put that glass down!" "No," he was shouting. My mother said very quietly, "Ali, leave him." My father rose from his chair and everything went red. At the same time as he began shouting at me, he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and I was being dragged across the kitchen, through the living room, through the hallway, out through the porch and the front door and across the yard to the shed where we kept our bikes. He threw me up on top of a workbench. He was baying now, not just shouting. You couldn't understand what he was saying, but I know it had to do with my hair and my water drinking and how fucking useless and insolent and pathetic I was, but it wasn't coherent. It was just pure, violent rage, and it was directed at me. There was a lone bare light bulb hanging from the shed ceiling. I remember looking up at it as he scrambled in a drawer behind me. Soon my head was propelled forward by his hand, the other one wielding a rusty pair of clippers that he used on the sheep we had in the field in front of our house. They were blunt and dirty, and they cut my skin, but my father shaved my head with them, holding me down like an animal. I was hysterical now, as hysterical as he was, but I knew he enjoyed hearing me scream, and it would be over quicker if I was quiet and limp. But that was so hard. I was in pain and shock, and I still hadn't had a drink of water, and I felt I was going to pass out with trying to catch my breath. All I could do was wait for the end. Eventually, it was over. He pushed my head one way, then the other, in order to inspect his work, then threw the clippers back in the drawer. "You get your hair cut properly, do you hear me?" he said, rage abating, coming down, spent. "Yes." I tried not to whimper. He whacked me across the back of my head and was gone. The shed door banged, and I was left to climb down from the bench. I made sure to clean up the mess. I gathered in my hands the clumps of my hair that had fallen to the floor and took them to the trash can outside. I returned to the shed once more to make sure everything was back to normal, and then switched off the lone light bulb and headed back into the house. I heard the sound of my dad's van heading up the sawmill yard, and I stopped for a moment, filled with shock and relief that he was gone. In the bathroom, I drank some water from the tap. Bits of hair fell into the sink as I drank, and I could feel droplets of blood on my neck. Finally, I stood up and stared at my reflection. I looked like a concentration camp inmate, and I wanted to die. Really, in that moment, I wanted to die. My mum tried to tidy up the mess with scissors to make it look less uneven, but there were patches that had actually no hair left at all that couldn't be disguised. I would have to go to school looking like this. I cried all through the night. The next morning my eyes were so red and puffy they were almost closed, but I was glad because they detracted from my head. I told my teachers I'd reached up to a high shelf and knocked over a jar of creosote, a wood preservative made from tar, and some had gone in my eyes. When asked about my hair, I said I'd try to cut it myself. Now, I have had more hairstyles than most men of my age have had hot dinners. It doesn't take a genius to work out that part of the reason I have so enjoyed changing the colour, length and look of my follicles over the years is something to do with reclaiming the power my father took from me in this regard, as well as many others, as a child. My hair has been blonde several times. It has been short and spiky, long and floppy, sleek, shaggy, and everything in between. I've even faced the clipper demons and shaved my own head more than once. It took a while to get to this place, though. In my late teens, there were several occasions when I was in a hair salon and would suddenly feel nauseated, and twice I actually vomited, not realizing until many years and quite a lot of therapy later that my body was manifesting physically what I could not yet cope with emotionally. I clearly had some deeply suppressed and deeply painful coiffure memory. But after I'd left home and was free from my father's grip, I began to make my hair a symbol of my own freedom. One time at drama school, in a particularly semiotic act of self-assertion, I actually agreed to my youthful locks being dyed purple by an overzealous hairdressing student and went back to the parental home for the weekend with my head held high, and nothing, not a word, was said about it. I did wear a purple sweater as well, in an attempt to divert all the attention, but still it was ballsy, don't you think? I suppose what I'm saying is, I'm okay. I survived my father. We all did, my mother, my brother and me, literally as well as figuratively. But as with all difficult things, it was a process. But more of that later. Thursday the 20th of May, 2010. I am standing on the stage of a huge marquee that houses the Cinema Against AIDS Gala in the gardens of the Hotel du Cap, just outside Cannes. I'm looking out at a sea of rich, tanned, chatty French people, all sipping champagne and gossiping to each other and ignoring me and smoking, smoking, smoking. I should point out that I'm not alone on this stage. I'm flanked by Patti Smith and Marion Cotillard, and the three of us are just standing there and absolutely nothing is happening. Luckily, nobody in the audience is paying any of us any attention at all, and it feels like we are trapped in celebrity aspic. Suddenly, the reverie is broken by a sheepish voice that turns out to be my own, saying into the microphone, sorry about this delay, ladies and gentlemen. We're, just waiting for Mary J. Blige to return to the stage so we can auction off a duet with her and Patty. Patty Smith's head whipped round towards me so fast I actually felt a draft. Panic made her eyes seem even more otherworldly than I'd remembered when she'd passed me on her way to the stage earlier in the evening. Right now, she was the spitting image of one of those girls in the Crucible, fresh from a hellish vision. What? She spat. What did we even sing together? No one told me about this. You may not know it, but Patti Smith is prone to spitting. I first met her at a party in a New York City clothing store a couple of years earlier. She sang a few songs as cute young people in black milled around, serving canapés and champagne to less cute older people in black. It wasn't very rock and roll, but then Patty changed all that. In between two of her songs, she spat. Not an, oops, I've got a little something stuck on my tongue kind of spit, but a great big throat-curdling gob of a spit. A loogie, as they say in the Americas. And she spat on the carpet. Several times. No mention was made of Patty's spitting by anyone in the store, least of all me, when I was taken to meet her after the performance. As we were introduced, I could see Patty sizing me up rather suspiciously with her Dickensian eyes. "You're the mystery guy, aren't you?" she said, pupils widening in recognition. "What?" I said, a little overwhelmed. "You're the guy who hosts Masterpiece on PBS, aren't you?" she said, as though she herself were one of the TV detectives I did indeed introduce as Masterpiece Mystery Host. I was just processing the fact that Patty Smith was an avid viewer of Miss Marple and Co., when she dealt me another body blow. "I've always wanted that job," she muttered wistfully. I made a pact with myself right there and then never to tell the Masterpiece people this information, as they would surely bump me and make Patty's wish come true. Can you imagine Patty Smith coming out of the shadows in a black suit, spouting forth about Inspector Linley or some malfeasance on the Orient Express, and ending each introduction with a resounding gob into a specially designed PBS spittoon? I can. It would be a lot more entertaining than that bloke in a suit with the funny accent they have on now. Meanwhile, Marion had walked to the side of the stage and was shouting to anyone who would listen, "Do something! Do something!" I admired her Gallic sense of injustice, but I knew her cries would be in vain. These kind of events, though seemingly glamorous and sophisticated from the outside, are often organised with the finesse of a kindergarten nativity play, and one whose teachers are all lapsed members of Narcotics Anonymous. Patty and I were left centre stage, both numb. She was presumably running through the list of songs she and Mary J. Blige might both know, which can't have taken long. I was thinking back to earlier in the evening. I had started the show with a song, That's Life, how sadly opposite it now seemed, and a monologue in which I was purporting to channel the spirit of Sharon Stone, the event's usual host and whose shoes I was filling, as it were. Alas, the crowd was underwhelmed. The only time the drone of chat slightly faltered was when I briefly made them think Sharon was watching the proceedings via a webcam from the film set that forbade her presence. "So make sure you bid high," I had warned, "because that bitch will cut you." A small crowd had gathered at the side of the stage, some offering advice, others offering their services to fill the embarrassing gap. Suddenly, Harvey Weinstein, the movie mogul and the man whose genius idea it had been to auction off the duet between Patty and Mary J. in the first place, came rushing in from a side door and blurted out that he had just been ripped a new one by Miss Blige. A visible and voluble tremor rippled throughout the gaggle of glitterati. Harvey does not get dressed down by anyone, ever, let alone a ferocious R&B legend who was on her way home when she heard her name being announced for a duet she also knew nothing about. Harvey had that detached air of someone who had just been mugged. I had a sudden thought that witnessing his encounter with Mary J. would have made a much better auction item than a duet between the two ladies. But I used my inside voice and kept that to myself. Harvey mopped the sweat from his brow and said that Mary had finally acquiesced and would be out in a moment, presumably when she had finished wiping his blood off her Louboutins. As Mary, Harvey and Patty returned to the stage, smiling as though they had planned all this years before, I fled the tent and snuck off to the hotel bar to drown my sorrows. I realised I had never actually liked Cannes. Well, I like Cannes, the actual town, but I'm not so keen on are those few weeks every May when the town is marauded by movie folk. My first ever Cannes was in 1992, when my debut feature film, Prague, premiered there. Looking back, it was all a giddy blur. The only film festival I'd ever been to before then was back home in Scotland, when a film I'd made in my last term of drama school, Gillis McKinnon's Passing Glory, had its premiere at the Edinburgh Film Festival in 1986. I remember that experience very vividly because it was the first time I'd ever seen myself on the big screen, and I was horrified by how my nose seemed to appear at least 15 seconds before the rest of my face. A less confident man might have avoided the camera for life. But I soldiered on, and here I was, not strolling up the Lothian Road and popping into the Edinburgh Film House, but cruising the Croisettes and monté l'escalier of the Palais des Congrès. That week I realised for the first time that glamour actually had a smell. But also, I was reminded that the industry I was in was show business. Film festivals are really just business conventions, you see. It could be photocopiers, it could be shower curtains, Cannes just happens to be movies. And I think any business convention, even such a glamorous one as the Cannes Film Festival, can only be interesting for so long because too many people are talking too much about the same thing. Their jobs. Or product. As not just photocopiers and shower curtains, but also films are referred to nowadays. Now don't get me wrong, I love my job. I love talking about films. But if that's the only topic of conversation available for days at a time, I get a serious bout of ennui. That night, in my beautiful room in the Hotel du Cap, that looked out onto the stunning terrace that sloped down to the twinkling Mediterranean where the little dinghies of paparazzi bobbed in the wake, I had funny dreams. I dreamed I was back on stage in the tent, and Harvey was auctioning off a kiss with me starting at $30,000, and nobody was bidding. The fact that this had actually happened to Ryan Gosling earlier that evening only further fueled the nightmare. "No, Harvey," I kept saying. "Be more realistic. Start at £100. I also dreamed of my mum, feverishly knitting lots and lots of pairs of socks to give as Christmas presents to all the new Asian relations she was about to acquire. "Yes, I'll run that by you again." You see, the very next day, I was to fly to London to prepare for the filming of an episode of the BBC TV show Who Do You Think You Are? A very popular programme in which celebrities have their genealogy investigated and studious, balding men in tweed jackets with leather patches on the elbows help the celebs pore over ancient parchments wherein family secrets are hidden. But not for long, of course, as a hitherto unpredictable secret is revealed and then the celeb cries. I'd been asked at the end of the previous year if I would be interested in taking part in the show and had immediately said yes. Then came the rather unnerving few months when the production company people went off and did some initial research to see whether or not my pass was worthy of a full hour-long probe. In other words, they needed to determine whether my ancestors were interesting enough. Being an actor, I'm very used to the notion of waiting for people to pass judgment on me. Audiences, critics, awards, juries, fashion police, all do it with such alarming regularity that it has almost ceased to be alarming. But this was different. This time the judgment was not about me, and yet it reflected on me. And I wanted very dearly to do this show, because it would give me the opportunity to get to the bottom of a mystery in my mum's side of the family, a mystery whose received explanation I had never fully bought and knew would be resolved by the programme once and for all. And hence the dream about my mum knitting socks for all those new family members I imagined I was going to unearth. Well, actually, there were two family mysteries. The other one involved my dad's side, the coming clan of Cawdor. Yes, that Cawdor. "Glams thou art, and Cawdor, and shalt be what thou art promised," and so on. Cawdor is a little village surrounded by forest and farmland in the north of Scotland, and Shakespeare had set Macbeth there without bothering to research the fact that the real Macbeths never set foot in the place because they died 300 years or so before Cawdor Castle was even built. This lack of attention to historical detail is more grist to the mill for my theory that Shakespeare, if he were alive today, would be writing for TV. But some were classy, though. My dad's family had been Cawdor Estate farm workers for as far back as anyone could remember. Cut to the 1980s. Like many privately owned Scottish castles, Cawdor's lairds were feeling the pinch and so opened their home to the public, thus commencing a stream of postcards, sent to me by various friends who had toured the castle, of a portrait of John Campbell, the first Lord of Coder, painted by Sir Joshua Reynolds in 1778 and hanging in the castle's drawing room to this day, that bears a startling resemblance to myself. I have a postcard of it in my study, and several friends have mistaken it for a still from some period movie I've done. Do you think there might have been a dalliance below stairs at some point? Perhaps the help gave a little extra? Hello? My imagination is pretty vivid and knows no bounds at the best of times, but now it went into overdrive, and I dreamt of future episodes of Who Do You Think You Are, revealing that I was, in fact, the rightful Earl of Coder. And then a special follow-up show detailing the difficulties of trading in my jet-setting Hollywood life for one of a Scottish laird dealing with grumpy American tourists and damp banquet halls. Of course, I knew that aside from going to Coder and wrenching a chunk of hair off the present Earl's head for a DNA test, something which was not in the remit of the rather scholarly methods of Who Do You Think You Are, there would be no way of proving the veracity of my potential claim to minor aristocracy. If some randy laird long ago got a chambermaid up the duff, thereby infusing the coming lineage with bluish blood, he would hardly be rushing to the village clerk to have it written in the annals for TV researchers to chance upon centuries later, would he? No. The real mystery, and the one I was happy to learn that the show was going to focus on, concerned my maternal grandfather, Thomas Darling. Although my mum, Mary, kept the surname Cumming after her divorce from my father, she is known to me, my brother Tom, and all our friends by her maiden name, Mary Darling. She isn't Mary, she is Mary Darling. This is mostly because her name so suits her. She is a darling. I'd spoken to her several times that week before I arrived in Cannes, as she'd been getting more and more excited about the start of filming. It was her father that the show was going to discuss, after all, a man she last saw when she was 8 years old, although he hadn't died until she was 13, 5 years later, in 1951. This is what I knew. Tommy Darling was from the north of England, an area known as the Borders for its proximity to Scotland, and was orphaned at age 2. He had married my granny and had 4 children, Mary Darling and her 3 younger brothers, Tommy, Don, and the now deceased Raymond. He was a decorated soldier in the Second World War, but after the war ended, Tommy Darling never came home. Ever. He joined the Malayan police force and died there in a shooting accident and was buried in neighbouring Singapore. But why had he never returned to his family? And what exactly were the circumstances of this shooting accident? In the run-up to the beginning of filming, my mind raced about the possible outcomes of Tommy Darling's story, but also about the way a family can have so little knowledge of a relation only one generation away. When little is known and less is spoken about, it's so easy for glaring inaccuracies to be smoothed over by surmise and assumption. I realised that I had no idea who my granddad was, and neither did my mum or my brother. Mary Darling's mum, my beloved granny, had died a few years before, but I never remembered her speaking of him. She had actually remarried after his death, and when her second husband died, there was yet more baggage heaped on top of Tommy Darling's faint shadow. If Mary Darling was excited, I was agog. I love a surprise, you see. I love the fact that I would not be told by the production staff where I would be going on this odyssey until the day it actually began, and each day could mean a different country, a different continent even. I'd been told only that the first week of the shoot would take place in Europe. Pretty vague. That I would start in London, but would need my passport at some point. I felt like a little boy again, that feeling that I would burst with the waiting and the suspense. And worse, although the show was normally shot in 2 consecutive weeks, because of my filming schedule, the second week and conclusion of the story would not happen for another month. I didn't know how I was going to manage to contain myself for a whole 4 weeks. I did know, however, that in 2 days' time, on Saturday morning in London, I had an appointment with a doctor to get some required jabs for the second part of the shoot, and after a quick search on the internet, I discovered that the countries those inoculations were required for included Singapore. So, hey-ho, call me Sherlock. I was pretty sure I knew where I was going to end up. Then. Memory is so subjective. We all remember in a visceral, emotional way, and so even if we agree on the facts, what was said, what happened where and when, what we take away and store from a moment, what we feel about it, can vary radically. I really wanted to show that it wasn't all bad in my family. I tried so hard to think of happy times we all had together, times when we had fun, when we laughed. In the interests of balance, I even wanted to be able to describe some instances of kindness and tenderness involving us all. But I just couldn't. I spoke to my brother about this. He drew a blank too. We remember happy times with our mum, safe, quiet times, but as a whole family, honestly, there is not one memory from our childhoods that is not clouded by fear or humiliation or pain. And that's not to say that moments of happiness did not exist. It's just that cumulatively, they have been erased by the dominant feelings that colour all of our childhood recollections. I can remember us all in a Chinese restaurant in a nearby town. We hardly ever ate out together, so when we did, it was a memorable occasion. But there is something nagging, too, about my memories of that place. Something that jabs at my heart when I think of it. I know that at least once in the few times we went there as a family, I must have been hit for some flaw my father perceived. Must have tried to hide my tears and humiliation from other diners. We surely had some meals there that were free of his mood swings and his tongue and the back of his hand, but they don't stand out for me. I can remember when I was very little in the living room at Panmure, at least 4 or 5 years old, playing horsey with my father. I see him balancing me on the foot of his crossed leg as he watched TV, and him bouncing me up and down to my squeals of delight. I remember being genuinely filled with joy in those moments. But as soon as a memory like that settles for too long in my mind, another darker one forces it to slide to the side. I see a freezing wintry afternoon in the sawmill yard. I am on the red bike I was given for Christmas, and my father has decided that today is the day that I must ride it without training wheels. To this moment, I have never once tried to ride without them. There is ice and snow on the ground, and I see my father taking the training wheels off and pushing me down the driveway too fast. Every time he does so, I panic and fall off, and soon he gets frustrated with my failure and pulls my trousers down and slaps me really hard on my bare bum. It's so cold I have no feeling in my toes and barely in my fingers. It's sore for me to sit down on the seat. I am scared, I am crying, and yet somehow my father thinks I'm going to be able to achieve what he has decided I must do. Each time I fall, despite my pleas and promises that I will practice and be able to ride without the training wheels soon, I am bent over his knee, feel the blast of freezing air around my genitals, and then severe, painful slaps to my behind. I don't remember how it ended. What I do remember is my mum washing me and getting me ready for bed in front of the living room fire later that night, and her gasping as she saw the ring of blue, black and purple bruises that had appeared. My father came in to say goodbye before he went out for the night, and my mother admonished him for his handiwork. "He's all right," he said, running a comb through his hair as he looked in the mirror. "You've gone too far, Ali," my mum replied as he disappeared out the door. Aside from visits to family, our holidays together were mostly to caravan or RV parks in seaside towns in other parts of Scotland. I remember when I was about 7, we went to Dunbar on the southeast coast and I got to play on the go-karts. There's a photo of me beaming in my shorts and crew cut, looking towards my mother and my father, who most likely took the picture. So it's not that every second of my childhood was filled with doom, but every second was filled with the possibility that in an instant my father's mood would plunge into irrationality, rage, and ultimately violence. This very feeling, this possibility, is what darkens the part of my mind where my childhood stories live. It's hard to explain how much that feeling of the bottom potentially falling out at any moment takes its toll. It makes you anxious, of course, and constant anxiety is impossible for the body to handle, so you develop a coping mechanism, and for us, that meant shutting down. Everything we liked or wanted or felt joy in had to be hidden or suppressed. I'm sad to say that this method works. If you don't give as much credence or value to whatever it is that you love, it hurts less when it is inevitably taken from you. I had to pretend I had no joy. It will come as a shock to people who know me now, but being able to express joy was something it took me a long time to be confident enough to do. I've certainly made up for it since, and for this, I am proud and grateful. Like any tyrant, my father was an expert at knowing how to hurt you most effectively and quickly. If Tom or I became too keen on any hobby or person, our father would ensure that they were removed from our lives instantly. Tom was a great soccer player and played for a local boys' club. Eventually, he began to receive interest from a professional team's scouts. Immediately, our father banned him from attending the soccer club altogether. I had a friend from school who lived in a local village, an arty girl who played the harp and whose parents were doctors. My father became convinced, based upon nothing more than a look in her eyes, that she was a drug addict, and I was never allowed to see her again. Both instances, I realise now, screamed of my father's insecurities, of me mixing with educated people whom he felt he could not relate to, and of Tom succeeding in a field in which our father himself once had aspirations. His actual violence towards us rarely lasted beyond one or two really hard whacks, the odd kick. I actually think the prolonged period of tension before landing his blows, as we were systematically inspected, chided, and humiliated, had a far worse effect than the actual hits. This certainly contributed more to our need to shut down, as we all learned early that the best way to cope in that time when his ire was building and his cruelty unfurling was to give nothing away, to try and become nothing, the nothing he both thought of us and wanted us to remain. But looking back from the vantage point of adulthood, I see that there was a definite sea change in my father's behaviour. I think I was about 8 or 9. Something transformed in him. He'd always been prone to outbursts of rage, but now a darkness descended upon him that meant the glimmers of light between the outbursts disappeared. It was as though my father was deeply depressed, and now I think perhaps he was. He obviously did not want to be in his marriage. He seemed to be perpetually irritated by the existence of his children, and nothing ever seemed to please him. Indeed, the only signal we got that something did not displease him was his silence, his inertia. Now began what I remember as a time of constant darkness, silence, and fear. Being around him was like navigating a minefield. We could never relax. We were never safe. He began to go out every night. I remember sitting in the living room with my mum, hearing him getting ready upstairs. Eventually, the door would open and his head would appear. "That's me away." But he would be gone before his words had left his mouth, his eyes not even seeing us. It was like he was saying goodnight to a pet, and eventually he stopped saying it altogether. I didn't understand what had happened, but of course I assumed it must have been something I had done. I was always being told by him how much of a disappointment I was, both in my appearance, my hair, of course, but also my posture, my weight, my nose, my moles, as well as my inability to perform the simplest of tasks, though his lack of detail in explaining what he wanted me to do, or the physical enormity of what was entailed, guaranteed I would fail. Once he actually demanded I drive a tractor, though I had never done so before, nor had any coaching on how to do so by him or anyone else. I tried to reason with him. Often he gave me tasks that were huge and would take till nightfall and beyond, but this was another level. Now he was asking me to actually endanger my life by operating heavy machinery, and I became very, very scared. My father began to shout at me, and I knew I had to meet his demand. I clambered up on the high seat. My feet didn't even reach the pedals. Of course, I made a mess of it, and the tractor lurched into a hedge and stalled. I was hit. And perhaps that was the first time I was relieved by the violence, because it meant the conclusion of an impossibly difficult and stressful experience. One night, as he popped his head round the door and lobbed his customary, "That's me away," I asked him, "Where are you going?" My mum looked up from her knitting. My father stopped in his tracks. There was no malice in what I had asked. I was genuinely curious, but nobody ever questioned my father, and I could see I was on stony ground. "Do you want to come with me?" my father replied defensively. "But where are you going?" I asked again. "You tell me if you want to come and I'll tell you where I'm going." I considered this for a moment. I knew my father was going out. He was dressed up a bit and he smelled of Old Spice and his hair was brill creamed. If he was going to the pub, I wouldn't be allowed in and would have to spend the evening in his van, something I did not want. But I sensed that perhaps there was more to it than that, and I think my parents could tell. My mum said nothing. "So are you coming or not?" my father said after a few moments, knowing he had won. "No," I replied meekly. I can't remember how I came to know, whether it was kids gossiping at school or something I overheard at home. But soon I understood that the change in my father's behaviour was because he was seeing another woman, and that Tom and I were a constant reminder of the life that trapped him. Soon after, one sunny Sunday afternoon, we all went to the beach at Carnoustie. As I've said, it was rare we did anything together, let alone anything as carefree and exciting as a trip to the seaside. Summers are short in Scotland and we tend to take advantage of the slightest hint of sun, and that day was no exception. Every time the sun peeped out from behind the clouds, we raced over the sand into the freezing North Sea, ducking under the waves for a few moments before rushing back up the beach again to the shelter of our striped windbreak, an essential component of any Scottish beach excursion. My mum opened the Tupperware box of sandwiches she'd made and we tucked in. Just then, a woman and her son appeared. We knew them locally, and they greeted my father very cordially, but I could see that the woman avoided my mother's eyes. They were invited to sit down and eat with us, and they did so. Conversation was stilted, and I did my boyish best to smooth things along. But I knew. This woman was having an affair with my father. That's why we had taken this rare family outing to the beach. And not only did he have the audacity to arrange this encounter and walk them to their car, leaving Mum and me to finish our sandwiches in shameful silence, but when he came back, he pretended that their appearance was a total coincidence. Even worse, he actually documented that sad day, that day when he stepped over the line of respect and made us complicit witnesses to his transgression, by taking a photograph of Mum and me. Me smiling obediently into the lens, my Mum gazing off to the sea. Friday the 21st of May, 2010, noon. By next lunchtime, I'd left Cannes and was back in Nice Airport, slurping down a Bloody Mary, a mandatory pre-flight ritual for me, and checking out the reports of the previous night's event online. I was happily shocked to read that, although not very forthcoming with their attention, the audience certainly coughed up the cash, as $7 million had been raised for AIDS research. Patty and Mary J must have nailed it. Mary Darling had left another message early that morning. She told me there had been a reporter from the Sunday Mail at her door. This wasn't unusual. Over the years, my mum had encountered several tabloid reporters on her doorstep, trying to get a comment from her about something or someone I had been rumoured to have done or said. Now she was quite an old hand at it. She said that this time the reporter was asking about my father, wanting to find out where he lived so they could ask him for a comment about something I'd said in a recent interview for The Times. My father had been estranged from his family for many years by this point. The British press, particularly the Scottish branch, was fascinated by this estrangement from his celebrity son and had made several attempts over the decades to goad Mr. Cummings Sr. into having his say about his lack of relationship with me. This was the usual pattern. A quote from an article I'd done for some other publication would be pounced and elaborated on, and then a suitably hysterical reaction quote would be sought, encouraged, or fabricated. I knew immediately which comments from the Times piece they would have latched onto. I'd done an interview in support of The Good Wife, the television show I'd recently joined the cast of, originally planned as a feature in the Relationships and Health supplement of the paper. During the course of a very wide-ranging and honest chat, the reporter had asked if it saddened me that I had no relationship with my father. "Of course," I'd said. "It's the saddest thing in my life." And it was. I explained a little of how my brother and I were still waiting for our father to take up our offer to continue a relationship with us. But I went on to talk of my belief that the way things were now was preferable to the situation that had existed previously, and that my mother and my brother and I were happier now than when there had been contact with my father, and presumably he was happier too. I'd said this many times before. It was true, but it was also my way of moving the conversation away from Alan's pain and into a more sanguine and healthy admittance that sometimes people do you a favour when they drop out of your life. And when the discussion turned to health, and I was asked about family illness, I told the reporter that recently when I'd had my first physical with a new doctor, he'd asked if cancer ran in my immediate family, and I realised that, as I'd had so little contact with my father as an adult, I didn't know. I actually knew nothing about him or his health. Then, out of the blue in the spring of 2010, my father contacted my brother Tom to tell him he was battling cancer. And Tom and I suddenly discovered which strain of that disease's odds were genetically stacked against us. As we were finishing, the reporter asked if I thought I would ever see my father again. I said I'd thought about this a lot, and imagined that the only way we might have any contact would be if he reached out as he was dying. However, the in-depth interview was scrapped in favour of one of those shorter, pithier, what I've learned pieces, and a collection of my words was assembled randomly under topic headings that bore little relation to the context in which they were uttered. My life is so much better now that my father is not in it. He does have cancer, which apparently runs in the family. Maybe next time I see him he'll be really ill, or he'll be dying, and I may not see him, is how the Times mashup ran. No wonder the Sunday Mail was sniffing about. Every person in the public eye will have stories of media invasion and misrepresentation. As, sadly, there were no classes at drama school for dealing with these sorts of things, I, like many before me, fumbled my way through the years and finally developed my own way of coping with this part of my job and my life, mostly by trying to be open and honest. I tried to be guarded about parts of my personal life in the past, but realised the hard way that doing so came over as coyness and invited speculation. In 1999, The News of the World, the most vicious of tabloids in both its disdain for facts and its methods of accruing them, ran a story implying that I was accusing my father of sexually abusing me as a child. This was completely false. I had done no such thing, nor had my father. But again, a comment I'd made about the aftermath of playing Hamlet in an interview with the American magazine Out a few months prior had been seized upon, misquoted, sensationalised, and then deemed irrefutable evidence of an accusation of sexual molestation. Here's what I actually said. After Hamlet, I just suddenly changed my life. I was not divorced, but separated, and I also confronted my dad with my brother's help. We went and talked to my father about the things he'd done to us in our childhood. Hamlet was probably not totally the cause of that, but it unlocked boxes in my mind that were locked away in the attic, and they all came out and I had to deal with them. It caused a lot of pain to many people, including myself. The next day, the Daily Record, sister paper to the Sunday Mail, ran a story with the headline, "Father of Bisexual Star Alan Hits Back," in which my father angrily denied my non-existent accusations. As you might imagine, all hell broke loose. I was in New York at the time, about to attend the premiere of a film I was in, a remake of Annie. Talk about the universe throwing you a curveball. When I got a call from Mary Darling, who just had her irate ex-husband on the phone, he was understandably furious. Every single person he knew would have seen the story. It transpired that the News of the World had been camped outside his house, and now other publications were ringing his doorbell. I felt sick. My father had terrorised me, Tom, and Mary Darling throughout our lives and was physically, mentally and emotionally abusive, but he was no sexual molester. I was horrified. But my horror was not just about how awful it must be for my father to be falsely accused of such a terrible act, but also that his rage was, right now, directed once more at me. The same fear and anxiety I'd lived with as a child suddenly reconsumed my life. I could hear it in my voice as I spoke to my mother. I could hear it in hers. I could feel it within myself. But worst of all was the fact that my father might think I actually had accused him of these things. My father did not really know me. He had no way of contacting me, as we hadn't spoken in years at that point. He also had no experience of dealing with the press or understanding of their disregard for reason in pursuit of a scandal. In New York City, Cumming Jr. was smiling for the cameras in an Alexander McQueen ensemble between frantic phone calls to see what could be done to calm his father, comfort his mother, take the tabloids to task, and demand an apology for this slander. Cumming Sr., at home in Scotland, also did what he felt was right. He talked. To his credit, he said he didn't want to carry on a conversation with his son via the pages of a national newspaper. But of course, he was saying that in the pages of a national newspaper. Eventually, I was able to secure an apology from the Daily Record. My publicist had told me that there was no way I could take on the News of the World, which had a renowned, huge legal fund purely for quashing lawsuits from the aggrieved subjects of its stories, as well as the knowledge that anyone who wanted to pursue them had to countenance an already painful story being raked through the papers all over again should they go to court. And although the few contrite lines at the bottom of the Daily Record's letters page a few weeks later were a far cry from the screaming headlines of the original story, it was important to me for my father to know I had done all I could to right this wrong. I wanted to show him that I cared about such an intrusion to his private life, that I was doing what I could to protect him. Of course, at the same time, I was reminded that my father had never shown those kindnesses towards me, and I wondered how different such an intrusion would have felt if he had known immediately that he could pick up the phone, tell me there were reporters outside his door, and hear my advice and my reassuring words. So now, back in the lounge at Nice Airport, I listened to Mary Darling's lilting Highland tones and knew what to expect. Probably a gossipy, needling piece in that Sunday's Mail. No big deal compared with what had come before, but able to churn up old sadness nonetheless. "But don't you worry, pet," she said reassuringly. "I just said I couldn't help them, had no comment, and smiled and shut the door." My flight to London was called. I took a last sip of my Bloody Mary and thought to myself, tomorrow's chip paper. And it was true. By Monday lunchtime, the Sunday Mail would be used for wrapping up greasy bags of fries in chip shops all over Scotland. But by then, the damage would have been done. So much more damage than I could ever have countenanced. We ascended into a cloudless Mediterranean sky, and as I always tend to do when airborne, I smelled the roses. Maybe it's the fact that I hurtle through the sky in a metal-fatigued box so regularly, and therefore the odds of said box careering to a watery grave must be quite scarily higher than for the average traveller, that makes me count my blessings in this way. Or maybe it's the copious amounts of free booze. Whatever, it's another inexorable ritual. But I smell the roses not just to remind myself of how lucky I am, but also to wonder how on earth it all happened. I smell the roses to try and figure out how I came to be in the garden at all. Then. Nobody disliked the rain more than my father. All of a sudden, nature would not bend to his will. Time would not mould to his form. His meticulous plans would have to be altered. Men would have to be redirected to new, hastily created tasks. The rain brought chaos to his carefully constructed realm. And on this particular day, I would become the unwilling and, as usual, ill-informed brunt of his frustration. This day was the first time I truly believed I was going to die. I looked into my father's eyes and I could see that in the next few moments, I might leave the planet. I was used to rage. I was used to volatility and violence. But here was something that transcended all that I had encountered from him before. This was a man who had nothing to lose. The very elements were raging against him, and what was one puny little son's worth in the grand scheme of things? I felt like I was my father's sacrifice to the gods, a wide-eyed, bleating lamb that he was doing a favour in putting out of its misery. It was during my summer holidays from high school. I was old enough to be working for him full-time by then, but not yet fully grown enough to be sent to aid the men with their tasks. So not only was I feeble and weak and inept, I also, in this current downpour, demanded more time and planning and attention due to my inadequacies. It was always like this with the rain. I longed for it as respite from the back-breaking labour, but as soon as it came, I knew I was doomed. We'd been working outside in the nursery, separating the 1- and 2-year-old spruce saplings that were strong enough to be taken to the forests and planted from the runts of the litter. These, much like me, needed to be cast aside. The rain had necessitated that this work be postponed, and instead all the saplings were transported into the old tractor shed in the sawmill yard, where they could be graded and selected in a dry place. This, I was told, was to be my job. I was sent to the shed to await further instructions. There was a single bare light bulb hanging above me. I stood beneath it, surrounded by mounds and mounds of spruce saplings, hearing my father's voice come wafting through the gale as he ordered his men around. Finally, the shed door opened and a gust of wind and a clap of thunder heralded his entrance. In the light bulb's dim hue, his lumbering frame cast a shadow over me and much of the piles of baby trees. I remember the smell of them, so sweet, fresh, and moist.
You go through these, he said, picking up a handful of saplings, and you throw away the ones like this. He thrust out a hand to me, but it was full of saplings of various lengths and thicknesses. With his shadow looming over me, I could barely discern the differences between any of them.
And you put the good ones into a pile over here, he gestured to his right.
I looked up at him, blinking and windswept. How do I know if they're good or not? I asked.
Use your common fucking sense, he said from the shadows.
A second later, a shaft of eerie grey-blue light filled